Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, Natalie Haynes on women in the Greek myths in her new book, Pandora's Jar. Natalie Haynes is a writer and broadcaster. She writes for The Guardian and The Independent, and she was a judge for the 2012 Orange Prize for Fiction, the 2013 Man Booker Prize, and the 2014 Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. She's also the author of three novels, The Amber Fury, The Children of Jocasta, and A Thousand Ships, as well as two non-fiction books, The Ancient Guide to Modern Life and Pandora's Jar, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Natalie, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's lovely to be back.
I should say the full title, Pandora's Jar, Women in the Greek Myths. So yes. Tell us what the idea behind this one is.
Well, I guess I've been sort of rewriting Greek myth for the last three novels in various ways. And one of the kind of nice things about having a slightly, what is it they call it, a portfolio career, as I do, is that it means I've been able to write stand-up shows, live shows, to sort of go with each novel. The novels are usually sad, the shows are usually fun. Well, I hope the novels are fun, but you know what I mean. And it became kind of a thing where people would say, you know, so in A Thousand Ships, what's the, you know, the real story of this? Or, you know, what's the original story of this? And I kept having to say at these talks, well, there isn't really an original version of this story, or, you know, there is no true version of this story. And I thought, actually, it would be really lovely to, between novels, to write a non-fiction book about 10 women in Greek myth whose stories have been sort of changed, distorted, sometimes lost through time, and see how that worked and why it might have happened. So, you know, the title is Pandora's Jar because Pandora is one of the great wronged women of Greek myth, down to a tiny mistranslation by Erasmus, I think.
Yeah, not only was Pandora wronged, but her jar was wronged as well.
And, everything about her was wrong.
We'll get to that in a moment. But yeah, the idea that if we know any of these stories, and, you know, a lot of us do know at least parts of the stories of these women.
Yes.
Where do we tend to know them from? Because it isn't the original versions.
No, it's a sort of mishmash. I mean, I think you would be hard-pushed to find a person alive in the UK today who doesn't best know the story of Medusa from the Ray Harryhausen Clash of the Titans. I mean, I think that's just true. It was on every bank holiday by law through our childhood. So, you know, it's been pretty tough to avoid. Sometimes I think they're sort of versions of Greek myths that we're given as children, you know, Roger Lancelin Green or Nathaniel Hawthorne, these sort of slightly oversimplified, in my view, versions of Greek myths that we got to read as kids. I don't think very many of us get to study them at school, unfortunately, or certainly not in Greek or in Latin in the case of Ovid. I think sometimes we come to them through artworks. Sometimes we come to them through studying English literature, you know, and you need these stories as kind of as backstory for the stuff that you're going to study in modern languages often. So I think people come at them through lots of different and sometimes contradictory almost directions. I guess my concern is that we tend to assume that the first version we encounter is, for want of a better phrase, the right one. And so it vexes me a little that a lot of those first encounters are sort of, you know, 50 or 100 or 150 years old themselves. So they have a whole modern set modernish set of prejudices, quite aside from the ancient ones they might be dealing with.
So let's start. We're going to go through a whistle-stop tour through the women that you write about in the book, and starting with Pandora. Yeah, and the book's called Pandora's Jar, but surely it's Pandora's Box, isn't it?
Well, only if you mistranslate it a la Erasmus, I'm afraid. So Erasmus is cheerily translating the story from Hesiod into Latin. Hesiod is in Greek. And he finds the word pithos, which means jar, and he translates it as pixis, which means box. And this might sound like quite a minor linguistic shift, but Greek jars, as I'm sure you know, are very, very narrow at the base and they widen right out. They're pretty unstable. They tended to be stacked on their sides. If you see them in museums sometimes, they're sort of lashed together because otherwise they'll roll off if there's an earthquake, or depending on where the museum is, this is a ever-present risk in some parts of the world. And, you know, you can see the cracks in them that have been repaired for them to be on display. So it's like, well, these don't look like very stable things. So, you know, it's quite a precarious thing to put. And then there's a debate about what's inside the jar. Sometimes it's bad things. That's the version we tend to think about. But sometimes it's good things. In some versions of the story, Pandora opens the jar. In some versions, her husband, Epimetheus, opens the jar. In some versions, the jar is simply opened. Sometimes we always seem to blame Pandora for it. But actually, you know, there's no particularly strong reason for doing that. And Hesiod tells her story two times. In what the first version, he doesn't mention the jar at all. In the second version, he does, and it is opened. But it kind of bothers me. Within about 30 years of Erasmus making this mistranslation, you start to see visual images of Pandora with a box. If you look at ancient visual images of Pandora, there isn't a single one which shows her with any kind of receptacle at all. She is always shown in the act of being created because she's made by all the other gods. And that, for the Greeks, is her big, you know, raison d'etre. It's the fact that she's the ancestor of all women. And, you know, and that's her big deal. The box thing is a huge issue for us. But it wasn't for them. It just wasn't interesting enough to include on the visual imagery that at least everything that survives of her. And I think what happens is that her story gets kind of overlapped with that of Eve. And so Pandora in Greek myth is a sort of agent of change. She shakes things up at Zeus's behest. He's angry that Prometheus has stolen fire from the gods to give it to mortals. And so he decides that a sort of price must be exacted, and that's having everything shaken up. But things have already been shaken up because now we have fire, right? So she is an agent of change. As soon as it's sort of overlaid with Christian iconography and values, then she becomes, you know, the woman who destroys the world by letting all the evils out into it. And you go, well, hang on a minute. Excuse me, I have a small question. So, yeah, I felt Pandora really deserved a bit of reclaiming.
And it's interesting that to contrast her with Eve, because the first Greek woman that you discuss in this book, this story...
She's the first woman, full stop. No women before Pandora.
And a lot of these stories, you can see where stereotypes of how people think of women through the ages have come from. So Pandora is the cause of all the trouble in the world. You know, we're going to get stories in a while of women invent stories about being raped. Women are terrible, you know, evil stepmothers. Women will kill your children.
Mothers, bad stepmothers, bad wives. Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of villainous women in this book, but I don't think any of them is a villain.
Let's move on to... Well, actually, I want to talk about some of the other... Because the idea of... before we move on, you talk about some of the other occurrences of this image that's come from, you know, our idea of Pandora's box and the thing in the box, particularly throughout popular culture. And you talk about, say, the fantastic noir film Kiss Me Deadly and Pulp Fiction,
for instance.
That is a
mad film.
Amazing film.
Absolutely bonkers. Yeah.
It's an image that even becoming, I guess even in sort of advertising and stuff, becoming disassociated from that original story of what it actually means is an image that we're all familiar with.
Yeah, and I think the value of the mystery increases when the size of the box decreases. That's my feeling. I think it reaches its pinnacle in that Twilight Zone episode called Button Button, I think, based on a Richard Matheson story, where a couple... Do you remember this episode? A couple is given a box.
I remember it from your book. I don't think I've ever seen that episode, but yeah.
There was a not particularly good feature film based on it with Cameron Diaz a few years ago, which I had to review, and I hadn't seen the original then, but luckily I knew a man who could help me out with some Twilight Zone DVDs. But there's this couple who are skint, and they have financial worries, and a man comes to their door, a stranger, and there's a box which he gives them, and it has a button on the top. And you can open the box. There's nothing inside it, as far as they can tell. No wiring, nothing. And he says, if you press this button, somebody you don't know will die, but you'll get $200,000. And then they have to sort of decide what to do. And I won't spoil the episode or indeed the book for you by telling you what they conclude is the right answer. But there is something absolutely, it seems to me, accurate in the idea that the sort of smaller it is, somehow the more hard it is to resist. I use the example in the book, and this is absolutely true. I generally don't struggle to keep myself safe. I'm pretty good at crossing the road. Actually, I'm terrible at crossing the road, but generally I look after myself pretty well. And yet I cannot see a little sachet of silica gel with the words "do not eat" on it without thinking, silica gel. I just can't do it.
Let's move on to Jocasta. And of course, a couple of years ago, we spent a whole episode talking about Jocasta and her children. And you sort of hinted at this in your introduction, but I wanted to sort of talk about how well this book works as a companion piece to your novels.
Yeah, I hope it does, because obviously I told Jocasta's story, for want of a better phrase, from the inside out in The Children of Jocasta, because it's a novel, so you get a lot of her inner life. And this time, obviously, it's a more analytic, you know, looking at her from the outside affair. But actually, what was interesting for me was being able to sort of finally unfold and say, these are all the places that my Jocasta came from. Because I think a lot of people assume, quite understandably, that the only kind of source we have for Jocasta is Oedipus Tyrannus, the Sophocles play Oedipus the King.
Not Oedipus Rex.
Not Oedipus Rex, because she's not a dinosaur. She's not Roman. You know I won't have it. But yeah, no, she only has 120 lines in that play. And so it's a really quite minor role. It's not even, I think it's about 8% of the dialogue. And the interesting thing about Jocasta is that there are different versions of her when she does get a lot more stage time. But the versions of the story of Oedipus and Jocasta, which we can see even across about a space of about 300 years in the ancient world, the differences between her are just astonishing. So the earliest version we have is in Homer, in book 11 of the Odyssey, where Odysseus goes down to the underworld to get some advice from Tiresias. The advice obviously can be abbreviated in every way to "don't poke out the single eye of the son of the sea god when you have a sea voyage to make home, mate." But anyway, spoiler. And he sees this set of famous dead women from Greek myth. And one of them is Callaen Epicastaen, beautiful Epicast, as Homer calls her. And he goes on to tell the story of Oedipus and Jocasta, who get married without knowing their mother and son. And then the news of their crime is revealed, and she rushes down to Hades, and he's left behind to rule Thebes, you know, bearing all this sorrow and guilt. And it's only a little 10-line version, but it's sort of pretty much 50-50. The emphasis is on both of them. And Jocasta obviously has a different name. She's called Epicast, but it's the same woman. When you look at, for example, the version of Jocasta that we can see in Euripides' play, The Phoinissae, which is a little bit later than Oedipus Tyrannus, but it draws on a tradition which dates back at least about 150 years to Stesichorus and probably further, then there's a version of their story where they are found out very quickly after, actually, well, not that quickly, I guess, after getting married, because they have enough time to have children. And Oedipus is bundled into prison, basically. He's sort of shut up in the palace because everyone's so ashamed of him. But she carries on being queen, you know, being queen of Thebes. And their two sons, Polynices and Eteocles, eventually take over and then declare war on one another. Spoiler, spoiler, spoiler. And the play, The Phoinissae, begins with Jocasta coming out and sort of revealing herself as this sort of high-end diplomat who's negotiating between these two warring factions, ultimately unsuccessfully. But still, this idea of a woman who's so shamed by her action that she kills herself on the day she finds out about it is simply not present here. You know, she is a woman who carries on having regal authority in this version of the story. And it's as old, as valid as the version that we all know a bit better. And I thought, well, there is something interesting, isn't there, about the fact that we've given priority to a version of the story where she's a really minor character and she just sort of disappears. And don't get me wrong, I bow to no woman in my love for the play Oedipus Tyrannus. It is an actual, absolute masterpiece. But because it's so focused on Oedipus's experience, it kind of sucks the light and air out of everybody else in the story. And when you see the story retold with more focus on her, on Jocasta, by Euripides, for example, you realise that your understanding of the Sophocles is sort of improved by knowing more about her in another version. You know, it's pretty rare that learning more about a character makes the story worse. So yeah, it was a real treat for me to be able to kind of explore these stories of Jocasta, and also to discover something which I hadn't up until that point known, which is that there aren't any paintings, vase paintings or sculptures of Jocasta from the ancient world at all. So we might have just been unlucky with what survives, but the more likely answer is that she's committed the ultimate crime against art, which is to be a woman over 35. So I'm afraid we're not allowed to see you. There we go.
Well, the concept of being a woman over 35 is going to come up again very shortly. Just as an aside, while we're thinking about other versions, multiple versions of all of these stories, there's a fella that keeps cropping up in this book who goes by the the name which never ceased to raise a giggle from me, of Pseudo-Apollodorus. What's that all about?
Pseudo-Apollodorus. For a really long time, we thought this book was written, this collection of stories from Greek myth, we thought and was attributed for a really long time to a writer called Apollodorus. And then it became clear, or reasonably clear, that there were a few, you know, academics hanging on to the idea that it might have been him, that it in fact wasn't him, but we don't know who it was. They are nameless. And so Pseudo-Apollodorus is what he's now known as. And to be honest, when I wrote the first draft, I pretty much 50-50 swapped between calling him by his full proper name, Pseudo-Apollodorus, or just calling him Apollodorus to save time. But in the end, I thought if we publish it with the Apollodorus, as it, then I'll just get loads of people writing him with green ink going, I think Miss Haynes will find, you know, oh, Christ, shut up. So I thought I would just save them all the effort, or at least they can, you know, obviously use their exertions elsewhere and find other things to be annoyed about. But yes, it is a funny name, I'm not going to lie to you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Natalie Haynes, and we're talking about her latest book, which is Pandora's Jar, Women in the Greek Myths. And Natalie, I said we were going to return back to the vexed issue of women who disappear out of popular culture once they reach a certain age. And I want to talk about Helen, because during the story of Helen, I kept getting sidetracked by trying to work out how old all of these people were. Because Paris abducts Helen, or takes Helen, before Achilles is even born.
Yes, it doesn't fit, and I'm afraid it's a perfect case in point of what happens with trying to find the right, with heavy inverted commas, version of a story. Yeah, so Helen and Paris elope, or he takes her, depending on your favoured version of the story. And then in some versions of their stories, I think in Homer, I'm right, in the Iliad, I'm right to say, they've already been away from Sparta for 10 years before the Trojan War begins. So they spend 10 years, like a sort of inverse odyssey, they spend 10 years either travelling to Troy or just living happily ever after in Troy before the Greeks invade. So that gives them 20 years, which just about. But yeah, it does. It is a real issue. And she has a daughter when she leaves Sparta called Hermione. But when she gets home, her daughter still seems sort of about a teenager. And the time seems to be kind of perpetually elastic in this and plenty of other parts of Greek myth. And so you have to work really hard to kind of square them off. But the reason, of course, is that you have these stories of Helen and stories of Achilles. They're such integral characters to the story of the Trojan War that their stories are being told by multiple bards across the Greek world over a period of, you know, hundreds of years. And so you'll end up with stories that focus really hard on a local hero element, for example. You know, when you get to the Amazons, you end up with a version of the stories which has lots of Theseus in it, and that's obviously come from Athens, where he's the local hero. And then, you know, if you go to somewhere else like Thebes or Tiryns, then you'll get lots of extra Hercules / Heracles, because these are the kind of local celebrities, I suppose, for the way that stories are told, and people want to hear about characters they like. And so, yeah, the Helen Paris timeline is absolutely impossible to fit around the people who fit around them. Try as hard as you might. And I had to work really hard with 1,000 ships for you not to notice. It made it through to about the 4th edit before eventually somebody went, can I just... Yeah, no, I'm sorry. You just can't make it fit for you. I've done my best.
Helen's a great example of a character where there are multiple different versions of her story, multiple different motivations for why Absolutely. She did what she did, or causes for what she did aren't there?
Yeah, and what she did is open to debate, because in the version that we all know, she's Helen of Troy. She goes to Troy, and that's the thing we know about her. But the version, which is at least as old as Homer, there's an alternative version of her story where she doesn't go to Troy at all. She goes to Egypt. And she spends the entire war in Egypt totally blamelessly, while the gods send an image of her, Eidolon is the word in Greek, so something which is made of air, but it looks exactly like her. And the war is fought in the same way over what the Greeks and Trojans both believe to be Helen. And then in the final moment, when the Greeks get their hands on her, she disappears into the air that she was made from. And so Helen gets her name kind of derided across the Greek world, but she's completely blameless. You know, she spends 10 years not having an affair with anybody, but being considered the great adulteress. So yeah, it's Helen's story is really, really difficult. And really, you know, the bit of her story that we don't kind of think about very often is the fact that she's abducted as a child. The Trojan War is the second war she's embroiled in, but she's abducted as a child bride by Theseus, who at the time must be in his 50s. And he and his friend Peirithoos, I think, decide they would both like daughters of Zeus as wives. And so they basically don't quite toss a coin, because coins don't exist yet, but they pretty much, you know, draw straws. And they decide to go down to the underworld and get Persephone for Peirithoos, and Theseus will just kidnap Helen. And at the time, according to various sources, she's either 7 or 10 years old. And some of those sources have her giving birth to a daughter before she's returned to her brothers. So the war is obviously quite a long time. It's like, we don't often, you know, when we have the sort of fun adventure of Theseus and the Minotaur, we don't spend very much time thinking about the bit where he's a predatory paedophile and serial killer of women. But anyway, here it is. So, yeah, and yet that's a story which dates back, you know, as I say, at least as far as Homer. And queasiness about Theseus's dubious decisions dates back certainly as far as Plutarch, for example, who's very uncertain about Theseus as a hero, precisely because he's so shady in his dealings with women and Helen as a child more than most.
It is interesting how, you know, even in the semi-modern era, somebody like Roger Lansland Green will tidy up the story of somebody like Theseus,
really?
Rather than, you know, say, well, you know what, these guys are all assholes, let's talk about Penthesilea or something instead.
Absolutely. I mean, it is kind of frustrating, because obviously I don't particularly want children's books to be full of, you know, scenes where women in Greek myth get raped, you understand. But there is something really dubious about sanitizing these male heroes so that their extremely unpleasant behavior, in the case of Theseus, who is, as I say, he's a serial killer of women and a serial rapist of women whose fathers he's killed, for example. And it is pretty unpleasant. And then you'll kind of get his story presented in children's books. Lancelin Green is the perfect illustration. And, you know, he's gone around killing some miscreants and that's it. And you kind of go, well, that's a very simplistic way of reading this. And I don't particularly expect a children's book to do something different from that, I guess. But it bothers me that there's no kind of corrective children's book where, you know, as you say, Penthesilea gets to go and fight and be a hero. I don't expect people to necessarily share every bleakest part of Greek tragedy with an 8-year-old. But it'd be nice if there was an alternative puffin book of Greek myths with women in it who get to do stuff rather than get erased from the stories of male adventurers who are extremely dubious.
And this wouldn't even have to be some sort of, for what, you know, some sort of woke revisionism.
It really wouldn't.
It wouldn't, because, you know, those Amazons were seen as incredible warriors at that time.
Absolutely.
As well.
I mean, Amazons were an incredibly popular part of ancient art and ancient storytelling, you know, and if we read Quintus Manaeus's Fall of Troy with the same enthusiasm that we read, you know, Homer's Iliad, we would all know the story of Penthesilea forwards and backwards, but we don't. You know, we prefer the story of doomed men fighting over other men rather than a doomed woman fighting, you know, for honor. And it's like, well, I have a problem with that because this story is also great. I don't want people to not read the Iliad. I just want them to also read this. And, you know, Amazons were an incredibly popular part of ancient visual arts. They're the second most popular mythological characters to be painted on vases in all surviving ancient Greek vases that we have in the 5th century. The most popular Heracles and the second most popular Amazons. We have the names of dozens of them painted onto vases. So, you know, we know the names of loads of Amazons. It's wonderful. But you wouldn't necessarily know that from the way that ancient Greek stories and myth are told now, because we just don't focus on those very much. And it seems to me a terrible shame. You know, if you want to get more people involved in reading classics and, you know, thinking about classics, it seems to me a peculiar choice to not emphasize half the world. Just a thought.
Of all the women you look at in this book, including, you know, ones that murder their own children, perhaps yes, the one with most in need of a good PR person is Medusa. How has the story that's come down to us of who Medusa is come about?
Well, this is a good question, because I think Medusa is one of the most interesting examples of actual literal monstering of a rape victim anywhere in history. So what happens with Medusa is that she is, well, to be fair, in one version of her story, which I think is in Pindar, she has consensual sex with Poseidon. But in most versions of her story, it's much less consensual. In some versions of that story, Pindar, it happens in a damp meadow, which I might add has exactly the same double meaning. If you're thinking fanar, go right ahead, it's in the Greek. But in some versions of her story, and the version that is perhaps most interesting to me, she's raped by Poseidon in the Temple of Athene. And Athene is so appalled by this act that she takes her revenge, not, as one might hope, on Poseidon, the rapist, but on Medusa, the rape victim. And her revenge is to transform Medusa. This story is in Ovid's Metamorphoses, so obviously a story of transformation, is to transform her hair, which is her great beauty, according to Ovid. She has very, very beautiful hair, so that it becomes snakes. We assume at this point this is where she acquires her lithifying gaze, but it doesn't actually say that in Ovid. She may have always had it, but we don't know that. And so it is a really extraordinary example. You know, when people ask about Greek myth and why it's still relevant and why we should, it's like, well, this is why, isn't it? It's because right here is an archetype, a metaphor for what happens to women who survive sexual assault. It's that people don't believe them and make them the villain of the piece. And that seemed to me so remarkable. It's going to be my next novel, Medusa. I was so astonished as I was writing the chapter. I was kind of confronting my own prejudices over and over again. And one of the things that made me really see it was there was a meme that went round when Christine Blasey Ford was giving her evidence to the US Senate Judiciary Committee. Do you remember? And the image that was very popularly doing the rounds during the previous presidential election, for example, had been images of Perseus holding up the decapitated head of Medusa, either the Canova, which is a copy of which is in the Met Museum in New York, or the Cellini, which is in Florence. But a triumphalist, I mean, literally the title of the Canova is Perseus Triumphant, this naked man holding up the body, holding up the head, rather, of a woman he's decapitated, a monster, perhaps we should see her as, that he's decapitated. And when Christine Blasey Ford gave her evidence, there was a meme that was just, I was so surprised by my response to it, that it properly made me reconsider how I looked at the world, because it was a gender switched meme. So it became a statue of Medusa as a very sort of lithe, athletic, beautiful woman holding up the decapitated head of Perseus. And in some versions of the meme, it was just that, a black background and this white statue. And in some versions, there was text and it said next to her head at the top of the screen, "Be thankful, we just want equality." And then next to his decapitated head lower down, "And not payback." And the first time I saw that, I gasped, literally gasped. I was like, "Oh, that's such a shocking image." And I thought, how many times have you seen the image of her head and not gasped? And I realized that not only was I trying to kind of dig these stories out of places like Pindar, or, you know, from the front of temples where Gorgon heads were once commonplace as apotropaic protective devices, but I was trying to dig it out of my own assumptions and prejudices. So, yeah, Medusa was an important chapter for me. I was raging about her mistreatment in a festival, book festival, also a festival last summer, to Philippa Perry. And she looked at me very hard and said, "I just don't know what's going to happen when you find out about the next 2,000 years of misogyny." It's like, Well, yes, that's you make an excellent point. But I felt just as angry. It felt just as fresh a wound to me as if it had happened 20 minutes ago. And I thought, oh, I must be ready to write a novel about somebody again, because look how angry and stressed I am.
We'll just do one more, and there's plenty of women we've not talked about. I guess I most regret Clytemnestra, because we don't get
Shall
to talk
like
again
this?
About well I want to talk about Medea to finish off with. Deeply regret the fact that there's not a stop motion version of Medea that we all watched as children.
I feel very aggrieved that she gets all her amazing moments taken out of. There's no good child murder in Jason and the Argonauts. In fact, there's not much good Medea in Jason and the Argonauts. I'm afraid that Medea gets sidelined by Honor Blackman being a hero, doesn't she? Because Jason and the Argonauts, and I love it, obviously, as a film, does suffer very badly from the Smurfette principle that you can only have one woman and hundreds of Argonauts at any given time. So, here we go. So, as I remember it, at least, in Jason and the Argonauts, Medea barely says anything, and she just turns up and dies and then gets revived with the shimmering golden fleece. But in Apollonius of Rhodes, for example, then it's Medea who, remember that big bronze giant that we're all terrified of? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Medea who kills him. And remember the snake that kills Medea in the film? Yeah, it's Medea who kills him, and so on and so on. So yeah, I always feel she's been mistreated by the fact that we kind of think of her as just being this villainous woman who kills her children. Although she is certainly also a villainous woman who kills children. That is undeniable. She has form for killing children, even before she kills her own children. So yes, she is a villain, but a villain I love, I'm afraid.
Well, I wanted to talk about how, interestingly, in comparison to like a lot of women's stories that have been sort of like forgotten, Medea is obviously still a, you know, a much performed and a much loved theatrical piece. But how in the modern day that story has been sort of softened for a modern audience?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I reckon I've seen about 30 productions of Medea over the years. I wrote my dissertation on it. You know, I think it's Euripides' play is just an absolute masterpiece, a masterpiece of characterization. It's one of the greatest roles women ever get to play in the theatre. And so I think that's why it keeps being performed and performed. And also it has a kind of contemporary resonance, which we might, you know, wish away, but it's not as present in a play like Oedipus Tyrannus, where, you know, most of us don't know, we might have a sort of psychological feeling about what it's like to want to overthrow a parent and to have a sort of attraction to the opposite sex who's a bit like our opposite sex parent, but generally most of us don't know what it's like to kill our father and marry our mother, I am assuming, whereas most of us have seen a couple who weaponize their children in a divorce, and that of course is what happens in Euripides' Medea. There are still, tragically, there are still cases of parents who kill children every year, and Medea killings, as they are often known. There's not a huge number, about two a year, I think. There are, I might add, we never talk about them in the same way, but there are, of course, Hercules killings, Hercules being a father who kills his children in exactly the same way, but we don't talk about it anywhere near as often. And I might add the play, which sort of, Euripides' play, which describes that, we don't see performed almost at all. I don't think I've ever seen it on the stage. In fact, I've only ever read it. You know, Plutarch was wise to this, and, you know, writing about Phaedra 2 millennia ago, he said, you know, there are other stories about Theseus being really dodgy, but those haven't been put on the stage. So he knew it was all about which stories we choose to tell and which stories we choose to ignore and which ones get the focus and which ones don't. But Medea is a play that I've been writing about for so long. When I came to write about it this time, I was still finding things in it which I hadn't noticed before. And I thought, God, I've been in conversation somehow with this play for, I don't know, 28 years or something. How am I still finding new things in it? But there you are. That's genius for you, I suppose.
So I've been talking to Natalie Haynes. We've been talking about her latest book, Pandora's Jar, Women in the Greek Myths, which is out now from Picador. Natalie, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
It is always a pleasure, every single time.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.